And welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston. I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners, and thank you for joining us today. Also, thank you for all your prayerful and financial support that's kept us on the air for over 40 years now and allows us to bring you great shows like today's. I normally don't make New Year's resolutions, but I'm going to make one today, and that's to get that intro updated. After 8 years, I think it's time. I know I've mentioned that before, but I have next week off, and I have some time to put something together, but we're going to get that updated. I am blessed to be joined today on short notice. We had another author that was supposed to be with us today and canceled yesterday or the day before. And Sophia managed to get Dan Leroy back with us. He's an author, journalist, and teacher who has been the director of writing and publishing department at Lincoln Park Performing Arts Charter School in Midland, Pennsylvania. Since 2006. His writing about music and politics has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Newsweek, The Village Voice, Alternative Press, Esquire.com, and National Review Online. Welcome back to the show, Dan. It's great to have you with us.
Ken, thanks again for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Yeah, a lot of times with our guests, I get just a minute to talk before we come on the air, and I was going back through my notes this morning, and we had Dan on back in 2021. He wrote a book called Liberty's Lions that talks about the development of the Catholic faith here in the United States, and made quite a few references in that book to the Philadelphia area. And so I remember that conversation well, and it's great to have you back. The book we're talking about today is going to be Why We Think What We Think. Again, it's going to be published by Sophia Institute, and I say going to be because it's not yet available. We think it hopefully going to be available in February. So I promise you, Dan, when we get a published date, I'll be sure to let our listeners know and remind them of the conversation we're going to have today to go out and pick this one up. But on short notice, I just got a quick copy of the ebook yesterday. Again, not completely finalized, but having never been a student of philosophy, and I've had some authors and writers on in the past that talked about specific areas of philosophy, but looking at this, so many people today you get into conversations and it's like, how did we end up here? How did our country, how did Western civilization end up today where, you know, everything is upside down, inside out, right is wrong, wrong is right. There is no truth, but there is a truth. And I think what you've attempted to do with this book is to answer those questions.
Well, I haven't. And, you know, I want to go back to something you said, which for me is one of the most important things. You said, I believe, like, I'm not a student of philosophy. And that means you are, and I think there's a lot of people who would be part of this, you're the target audience for this book. Because one of the reasons that the world is in the state that it is in, as you so well described a moment ago, is that philosophy is a thing that has been abandoned, a subject that's kind of left to the academics. In fact, somebody asked me in another interview the other day, what would you say to someone who said that, you know, isn't philosophy something that's only for the smart people, for the philosophers, for the professors? Yes, and look where that's gotten us. It's not in a very good place, I would say. So part of the reason for doing this book is to write a book, not just about philosophy, but an accessible book about philosophy, a book that somebody who has not studied it in any particular way can pick it up, become acquainted with where these ideas come from and how they, you know, whether we think philosophy is part of our lives or not, it is part of our lives. Mm-hmm. And knowing what the links are is really important if we're going to have any hope of changing anything. So I was glad to hear you say that, because that is exactly the type of person that I hope will be willing to read this book.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when we say we don't study philosophy, right, I think everybody has a philosophy for their life, whether they it's conscious or subconscious. But, you know, it's based on what we learn, I guess, and who we learned it from. And in looking at the book, you know, it's names that everybody's familiar with, the Aristotles, the Socrates, the Platos, Thomas Aquinas. And everybody knows that these were, you know, highfalutin intellectuals that, you know, tried to answer, you know, the ultimate question is what is life or what is the meaning of life? And so I think the book's going to unpack this. I did chuckle though when I opened it up in the prologue. Like you said, people, you know, kind of given up on it a little bit. And you say that you tell the joke, how can you make a philosophy student get off your porch? And it's just paying for the pizza. So, yeah, I know if one of my kids would come home and say, you know, I'm going to go for a philosophy degree, and it'd be like, well, if you're going to be a religious perhaps or something, that's fine. But I don't know what else you do with a philosophy degree except go out and teach.
Well, and it's true.
Yeah.
It is true, and it really reflects something that I think is, again, it's sort of a marker for how we've gotten to the place where we are in the much bigger picture. But it's also a reflection of something, the really tragic thing is, this is a thing that philosophy has done to itself. This was not done to philosophy from the outside. You know, many people have the belief that, well, science came along and made philosophy irrelevant. No, it didn't. Philosophy made itself irrelevant as a discipline. This was a choice that was made over the course of hundreds of years, and the roots of that choice are philosophy tried to extricate itself from any sort of involvement with theology. In short, philosophers for a number of centuries tried to figure out, hey, how can we figure out things that we can know for sure that don't involve God? Let's keep God out of this and let's see what we can know without him. And you know what the answer is? Not much of anything.
Exactly.
And once philosophy reached that tipping point, which in the book I make the case that it really happens during the Enlightenment with the Scottish philosopher who's maybe not as familiar to a lot of people, David Hume. David Hume is like the ultimate skeptic. By the time we get to David Hume, philosophy as a discipline has concluded that there's really nothing that we can know for certain. And it's not a coincidence that David Hume was also one of the, you know, the first really prominent and out there atheists among philosophers. So to go back to the original point, it's really tragic what's happened to philosophy, but the tragedy is because this is the thing that philosophy did to itself, which is sort of the definition of tragedy. You know, a tragic hero is somebody who is responsible for their own downfall, and that is very much the case in the discipline of philosophy.
And Dan, is that because people that would call themselves philosophers and studied philosophy, was their aim to take God out of the equation, or was it some kind of intentional thing that happened over time where we're gonna take God out of the equation? And I think, like you're saying, that where we are today is a direct result of having not only taken God out of the equation when it comes to philosophy, but when it comes to life in general.
You know, that's a great question. And I think sometimes the answer is yes, it was very conscious and deliberate. Sometimes it wasn't conscious and deliberate. In fact, to follow up this kind of tragic idea, sometimes what happened is the result of people who were, by all appearances, fairly faithful Catholics, or at least fairly faithful Christians who, through, how would we say this, through not really looking at the consequences of their actions, unleashed things that we're paying the bill for right now. And a good example of a guy like that, he was certainly not a Catholic, but he was a believing Christian, is a guy named John Locke, who in a lot of ways, you know, we were talking about the Liberty's Lions book and about the American revolutionaries. John Locke, in a lot of ways, is the founding father of the founding fathers. Without John Locke, Thomas Jefferson never writes the Declaration of Independence. John Locke is probably one of the most influential philosophers of all time. But John Locke's philosophy also contains in it the seeds of a lot of the ills that we're living through today. You know, John Locke was a guy who, even though he was a believing Christian, John Locke was all about individual liberty, and individual liberty kind of heedless of the consequences. You know, as Americans, we're used to the idea that liberty is a good thing. We want more of it. But if you look at Locke's writing, you will see that Locke is a guy who tries to weaken, through his philosophy, the commitments that we have to pretty much anybody and anything, including our spouses, our children. All relationships are voluntary. There isn't anything we do that we don't get the final say over whether we should or shouldn't do it. And, you know, in the early days of our nation, when it was a Christian nation, when we had that sort of unifying quality about it, we could get by with this stuff. But obviously today, that's not where we're at. And so in that kind of society, a philosophy which says you don't owe anything to anybody and you can do whatever you want and any commitment you make is purely by choice, well, we're living through the damaging consequences of that philosophy every single day in numerous ways.
And don't we know it? You know, one of the things that it comes up often, and you know, being in this position and interviewing a number of authors and journalists and folks in the Catholic Church, you know, the running theme of late is that we as human beings, we try to avoid suffering at every turn. Nobody wants to suffer for anything, and yet Jesus Christ himself told us that, you know, to follow, if we're going to follow him, there's going to be suffering involved. And I happened to be listening to a podcast with a couple of guys today that were talking about just that, and the joy that people have gotten, and especially those in the Catholic Church, the saints and what have you, the joy that was in suffering. And so somehow or other, I guess we have to explain away suffering, that, and we avoid it at all costs. And, you know, I think philosophy used to try to attempt to explain suffering, but without God, suffering has absolutely no meaning and is to be avoided at all costs.
It's a very profound observation. And as you just said, you know, in the history of philosophy and in this book, we find great Christian, great Catholic philosophers like Augustine and Aquinas who address this very explicitly. But after them come a number of philosophers who, I guess I would explain it this way. You have a number of philosophers who move from the idea that nature is a thing that exists on its own. It is not a thing to be controlled by man. It is a thing that man has to accommodate himself to. And there is a point, you could probably fix this to somewhere in, you know, let's say the after the medieval period, probably in the around the time of the Renaissance, that changes. You could look at a philosopher like Sir Francis Bacon, the great British philosopher, who his catchphrase was "knowledge is power." You know, in the old days, going back all the way to the classical tradition, the Greeks, the Romans, and then later the Catholic philosophers that we just mentioned, Augustine, Aquinas, knowledge is good for its own sake. We are made in God's image. We are given the power of reason, and therefore knowledge is a thing that we have to seek because it's good, because we're seeking after the truth. That changes, it really changed, I would say, before Bacon, but Bacon is the guy who gives us that the nice, tidy catchphrase, knowledge is power. At that point, knowledge is not something that's good on its own. It's good because it allows man to predict and control nature. And at least from that point on, suffering, to go back to your point, well, predicting and controlling nature is in large part so that we can avoid suffering. And we have to give credit. We can think of lots of examples where science, through the development of medicine, through the development of technology, has certainly given us inventions that have alleviated human suffering, and that's something to be grateful for, but, you know, it never stops there. And again, today, we're living through the consequences of a society where we believe that the ultimate goal is not heaven, it's not finding the truth, it is doing whatever we can, as you said, to eliminate suffering. And, you know, you'll hear a lot of people today who are very bullish about artificial intelligence to the point where they will fantasize about the idea that, you know, we will merge with the machine and we'll be able to upload our consciousness and we'll be able to live a life where there is no more physical suffering because there isn't anything physical to suffer over. I've seen that movie a whole bunch of times. I know how it ends every time, and so do you.
Yeah.
But that never stops people from being so captivated by this idea that there's a way out. There's a way to avoid suffering if we only come up with the right invention. It's sort of like Nietzsche's idea of the eternal return. We just keep coming back to this idea, no matter how many times it's proven wrong, it just seems irresistible.
Amen. So we've kind of gone off in a few different directions here, but in the format of the book, you start out with the big three. And it was interesting looking at the chapter titles, and I haven't read the book, so I'm not quite sure how the gadfly was Socrates, the swan is Plato, and the philosopher is Aristotle. But they're obviously the big three that actually started this field, if you will, and the three great seekers that sought the truth.
And, yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're good.
I think, though, you know, what you just said, that, you know, they're the thing that all three of these guys have in common, and the thing that ought to draw us to them, even though technically, you know, they're pagan philosophers, they're guys who were working before there was Christianity. The thing that should commend them to us is that they're seeking after the truth. And the idea that there actually is a universal truth, that there are universals, period. We have, you know, there's a universal morality. That's something that all three of these guys believed, and it's one reason that Augustine found it so easy to, as they say, baptize Plato. And even though he had more of a challenge, Aquinas was able to baptize Aristotle. They were able to do it because the Greeks, those three Greeks in particular, they did have that in common, and they had that in common with us as Catholics.
And so they pursued the truth regardless of where it led them. And, you know, I think about that today, you know, when 1,500, 1,800 years later. And, you know, we'll pursue the truth, but not if it involves God. But back in back in Aquinas' time, to your point, and I don't know about the great Catholic leaders up until that point, but he was open to looking at their body of work and then building on it, because he was able to bring God into the equation, and in that truth that the Greeks were seeking. They didn't have the information that the Christians had. And so when they tied the two together, or they added, you know, the Christian faith on top of their body of work, it helped them to explain a lot more, didn't it?
It did. I mean, I think that's a great description of really how we got to what I think is the high point of Western philosophy, which is Aquinas. And Aquinas did what you just said. He was able to take the stuff from the Greeks, from the classical tradition. He was able to figure out a way to, again, as the saying goes, baptize it. He was able to bring it in line with Christian thought in a way that didn't compromise Christian thought and didn't compromise the philosophy. It was controversial at the time, and he made some enemies, some of whom, not long after his death, tried with some degree of success to undo what he had done. But if you look at it today, there are a lot of people, again, who will say, well, you know, science came along and it invalidated all stuff. No, it didn't. Aquinas' body of work has never been refuted. It's just been ignored. And it was ignored because of the implications, which had to be ignored, and the implications were contra human freedom. It means we as men don't get to decide the ultimate truth. That's already been decided. We don't get to pick that for ourselves. Well, that's an idea that it has enemies. There are a lot of people who want to be the boss of everything. They're the view that man can kind of create himself, that's a very seductive idea. It's been around for a long, long time, and a philosophy like Aquinas goes against that, and so therefore you're going to have people who are going to work to undermine it. Sadly, some of the people who worked to undermine it were also within the Catholic Church, and that is also one of the great tragedies of philosophy.
Yeah, and one of those folks that I saw the name in the book, and so the show I do before this one with a good friend of mine and priest, Father McKay, we talk about the saints in the liturgical calendar, and you know every year Don Scotus will come about it. He's not a saint, he's still a blessed, and then I noted in your book that, you know, even though he's was probably one of the biggest promoters of the Immaculate Conception. And it's like, and when I thought about it, he's, you know, saying that something is true that can't be proven. And yet he was one of the ones, I think, that you point out in the book that came along and undermined some of the Catholic philosophy.
He did. And it was really his student, or at least we believe, that he was Duns Scotus' student. That's William of Ockham, who gave us Ockham's razor. He was the guy who really did the heavy lifting in terms of undermining Aquinas. And, you know, the sad part of it is the reasoning you can understand. Duns Scotus and Ockham and others as well believed that Aquinas was taking on too much. They believed that by adopting Aristotle's philosophy, which also involved, to some extent, taking on some of Aristotle's science and his way of looking at the world. And Dunscotus and Ockham believed, hey, you're claiming that you know way too much about God. We're not capable of knowing this much about his plan. We need to know our place, and knowing our place means that we need to make faith the primary way that we understand the stuff. And this system that Aquinas developed, that's too much. Hmm. And I don't think it was too much. Other people don't think it was too much. But, you know, that idea had its adherence. And, you know, when you hear people talk about when you hear people talk about religion being something that can only be experienced through faith, well, the roots of that go back even before the Protestant Reformation. They go back to Dunscotus and Ockham, who, in making this claim, really undid a lot of the great work that Aquinas had developed. And it wasn't something that happened overnight. Certainly, this is a process that takes hundreds of years. But it's a shame that the Catholic Church could not unite itself behind this guy who, in the view of many people, including me, is one of the two or three greatest philosophers who ever lived.
Amen. That brings us just about to the bottom of the hour, Dan. So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. And my question is going to be, I'll set you up now, is in some of the political discourse that you hear, some of the commentators that are out there, I hear this Occam's razor being thrown around. I had never probably heard the term until the last year or two. And now it gets used a lot, and we'll start out maybe by explaining to our listeners what that is. Don't go away. We'll be right back with our guest, Dan Leroy.
My name is Mario Diadamo, and I have been a faithful listener to Inner Sign Radio Ministry since 1990, and to Kathleen McCarthy as principal host since 2007. Hearing the witness of Kathleen and her guests has contributed greatly to my spiritual growth. They have educated me about the tenets of my Catholic faith by presenting lay and religious leaders discuss topics that help listeners create an informed Catholic conscience. I always encourage people who are in need of prayer and companionship to listen, call in, and become part of our radio listener family by joining thousands of other people praying for your intentions. I personally can attest to the power of the prayers from the ministry. Kathleen often reminds her listeners that you are never alone because the Lord is always with us. Through this Catholic radio and internet apostolate, the Lord is indeed with us in a very tangible way. Please share the good news as Kathleen takes a leap of faith and expanding to a two-hour program to reach many more people who need to experience the love of God. Thank you.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We are blessed to have had this Catholic radio apostolate for almost 40 years now. Thanks be to God for your partnership. Without you, this radio voice would be silenced. We have a monthly Mass offered for you, our loyal family of listeners. It's our way of saying thank you for underpinning our apostolate with your many prayers and financial support. This is your radio ministry, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to evangelize and to catechize for a time such as this. We know the Lord will bless you abundantly. He can never be outdone in generosity. If this ministry has touched your heart, help us to touch other hearts by supporting us with your prayers and financial support. Call us at 610-527-2906 or visit our website at inhissign.com.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston. Again, I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners, and thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio, both your financial and prayerful support that allows us to bring you shows like today's. Our guest today is Dan LeRoy. We had him back. He was here a couple of years ago talking about a book he had written previously called, now I'm going to forget the name, Liberty's Lions. And he's written a new book, and not out yet. It's due out in February. I'll be sure to remind you when we get an official release date. But this book is entitled Why We Think What We Think, and deals with the topic of philosophy. And the first segment we were talking about the original three, or the big three, being Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato. And we were talking a little bit more about Thomas Aquinas, and then how things began to unfold with the rise of Don Scotus and Occam. And before we went to the break, I was going to I'd ask Dan when we come back to explain Occam's razor. He mentioned it, and I don't know if it's only certain political commentators, but I've heard a few of them now refer to Occam's razor when they're talking about things that are currently going on. And I thought, since you brought it up, Dan, maybe you could just take a minute to explain what that was.
I will. And Occam's razor, I think when you hear it, it becomes kind of a familiar idea. In simple terms, it says that the simplest explanation for something is usually the best. If you're presented with two competing explanations, the one that has the fewest steps, the fewest amount of moving parts, is generally the one that you ought to accept, because there's less chances there for making an error. And that was an idea Occam gets credit for. He didn't actually invent it. It's an idea that goes back at least to Aristotle and other philosophers, including Don Scotus, who was a mentor of his. They all kind of entertained a similar idea. But Occam is the guy who gets credit for it, maybe because he's the guy who used the razor the most, and he used the razor to really shred a lot of the work that Thomas Aquinas in particular did, and he did it, as we were saying before the break, he did it because he thought that he was defending, let's say, God's sovereignty. And Don Scotus did a similar thing. Both of them were arguing that, look, in trying to explain the world and trying to say that God has left us clues in the natural world to understand his creation, they were arguing that that's limiting God. God can do whatever he wants at any time. And unfortunately, it's one of those disputes that you think, wow, did it really have to happen this way? Wouldn't it be possible to acknowledge that, yes, God can do whatever he wants? And sometimes we see that manifested through miracles, let's say. But just because miracles can happen doesn't mean we have to throw out all of natural science just to prove that God is almighty and has the ultimate power. We can acknowledge that and still believe that he's left us clues in the natural world to help us understand it. Unfortunately, that's not the way the dispute went. And so Occam's razor is kind of a tool to simplify things, but the way Occam used it, it really became a tool that wasn't so much about simplification as it was just shredding any kind of claim that human beings can understand God and his creation. And where that leaves you is, Well, the only way then that you can know God's will is to have this individual relationship with God. But that is that's a pretty difficult and dicey proposition for a lot of people. How are we supposed to know God's will for us individually? Well, that leads you later, centuries later, to existentialism through people like Soren Kierkegaard, who would say pretty much a version of that same thing. The only way to know God is through a completely individual, completely personal relationship with him that has nothing to do with his relationship with anybody else. So every action you take has to be evaluated in light of this very individual and personal relationship. That's a tough philosophy. That is not a philosophy for the faint of heart, and it's not a philosophy, I think, for most of us. So Occam's razor is sort of the beginning of that whole idea.
Very good. And so it begins with them a few hundred years ago, and over the centuries now, we've kind of devolved to the point where we've gotten to today. And I don't know if there were significant steps between then and now, like anything that jumps out, Dan, where, you know, there's a particular place in history or a person in history we can point to that made a significant contribution to the suicide or the demise of philosophy.
I mean, it's a pretty long list, actually, and it takes up a good chunk of the second half of the book. But there are certainly people, including some that we've talked about already, you could point to, again, scientists like Sir Francis Bacon, whose catchphrase, knowledge is power, means that human beings have to use knowledge to their own ends to predict and control nature. You could look at a philosopher like Thomas Hobbes, who had a very, very pessimistic view of man in his natural state. You could look at John Locke, who we mentioned earlier, a guy who's one of the inspirations for American liberty, but whose idea of liberty, if you look at it closely, means that nobody really owes anything to anybody, and we only make voluntary commitments, which we're allowed to break whenever it suits us. You could look at a philosopher like Immanuel Kant, who was a German philosopher of the late Enlightenment period. He's a guy who kind of divides the world into two parts, the nominal world and the phenomenal world. And the nominal world is a world that we can't have any knowledge of. And he puts God, if he exists, into this nominal world. But he pretty much says, look, this is a thing that human beings don't have the capability of knowing. So he never came out and said, you know, there is not a God. He was very careful not to do that, in spite of the fact that it seems that he really didn't have that belief himself. But he basically walls God off and says, look, this is a thing that's not a fit subject for us to discuss because we don't have the tools to do it. And a lot of people, including right up to the modern day, take their cues from Kant's approach and say, well, you know, let's not talk about anything metaphysical because there's no way to prove any of this stuff, which includes any discussion of God, any discussion of religion. Let's just leave that out of bounds. And, you know, all of this limiting of what is fit for philosophy to talk about ends up in the 20th century, philosophy's reduced to really linguistic philosophy. Just talk about words and how we use words and what we can know for sure just based on the arrangement of words on the page. It's really shrunk down to this very, very small and for a lot of people kind of meaningless concept. Now, the place that we see that today is in the battles that we have over language. A lot of that owes to these linguistic philosophers and analytic philosophers of the first part of the 20th century who took great delight in parsing a sentence down to its component parts. And, you know, a lot of these language battles owe something to that preoccupation with language, which is really sad. There's philosophy saying, well, we can't talk about this, we can't talk about this, we can't talk about this. What can we talk about? Well, let's talk about talking. Let's talk about language. It was like that was the only thing that was left.
Yeah, and that doesn't make for great conversation, does it?
Unless you're an analytic philosopher.
Yeah, and it, you know, and to see how, you know, language is, you know, co-opted and used, and think about some of the words that we can never use when we were kids that are now part of, you know, regular discourse, and that there's other words that, you know, you used to use regularly that, you know, God forbid you mention them now. And it amazes me how, you know, those that are a lot wiser than I am and supporting various causes can co-opt the language in order to get or try to force people into, you know, areas that are into doing things that they never had any intention of doing or thinking.
Well, sorry, mean to interrupt there.
No, you're good.
I was just going to say, you know, that in spite of the fact that a lot of this stuff is comparatively recent in origin, it's also really, really old. If you go back to the ancient Greeks and you go back to the sophists who were, they were legal advisors, and they were guys who, because of the court system that was developing in Athens around the 5th century BC, these are guys who essentially will help people argue their case in court. You know, they're lawyers in other terms. But we get the term sophistry from these guys because their whole thing was, hey, look, it doesn't matter what you're arguing. It's really in how you argue it. There is no absolute truth. There's only who comes up with the better argument and who can get everybody to play along. And that's an old, old idea that we still see playing out all over the place every day today. You have your truth and I have my truth, and there is no absolute truth. It's everybody's individual truth. Well, that's a very modern idea, and it's also a very, very old idea. And these guys, you know, they were arch enemies of Plato. That's how far back this idea goes. So even though a lot of the damage that has been done to philosophy has been done over the last 100 years or the last 150 years, it usually goes back much further than that. And that's an example of just how old, how seductive that idea is, that, you know, there are as many truths as there are people. And we know why somebody says something like that. It's generally because I want to have my truth because I want to do what I want to do. And I don't want you coming around here with your truth and telling me that what I want to do, I can't do. You know, that's an idea that's just about as old as people.
I see it. I mean, you go back and, you know, for whatever reason, I'm thinking about Herod and John the Baptist, and, you know, Herod wanted to do what he was doing, and, you know, John the Baptist was getting in the way. And so, you know, that goes back at least a couple thousand years. And so It just gives credence to that old saying that, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So got a few minutes left here, Dan. So where does this all lead?
Well, we were just talking about, you know, where it leads in one sense, which it leads to a lot of the problems that we see on a daily basis. It leads to this idea that philosophy, as we were saying in the first segment, philosophy is a joke. Philosophy is not a thing that anybody takes seriously. It's not a thing you want your kid to go study. It's not a discipline for anybody but, you know, someone who wants to be an academic. It's really got a terrible reputation, which, again, as we were saying earlier, it's a thing that it did to itself. And it has also led us, because, you know, philosophers in this dwindling set of ideas that they're able to talk about, you know, it leads us in the mid to late 20th century to things that we're familiar with hearing about today, the critical theorists, the deconstructionists, the postmodernists, who realize that if we're really going to get ultimate freedom for everybody, we have to make sure that there is absolutely no ultimate truth, no thing that anyone can agree on, except, of course, what the deconstructionists and the critical theorists and the postmodernists say is true. But we have to wipe out all possible claims to any sort of overriding truth, because that's the only way that we can give people the freedom to do what they want. And even science, which was the thing that, you know, promised to give us the facts and promised to give us the unbiased and unvarnished truth about everything, hey, even science gets in the way sometimes of what people want to do. And as we've seen in recent years, if science gets in the way of what somebody wants, well, we're going to get rid of science too. Science is just as much an enemy as philosophy. So on the one hand, it's pretty bleak where all this has led us. But on the other hand, the thing, you know, you hate to write a book that's this long and then end up with that kind of conclusion. So you try to find some hope. And where I think we find the hope over the last 100 or 150 years is in this new wave of Catholic philosophers. There have been a lot of them. They rarely get talked about in any conventional histories of philosophy. And yet, you have some of the greatest thinkers of the last couple of centuries who are Catholics. Some of them are popes. Goodness knows they never get any credit for being philosophers of any stripe. And yet, when you talk about people like Pope Leo, you talk about people like St. John Paul II, you even talk about Pope Benedict. These are guys who were serious thinkers, serious philosophers. You talk about people like the last guy I mentioned in the book, Alistair MacIntyre, who is the only guy mentioned in the book who is still living. I think he's 94 years old now. And he's really representative of, I think, a reason to be hopeful. This is a guy who, you know, he was a Marxist. He was an atheist. The book that he wrote, for which he's most famous, After Virtue, he was not a believer at the time, but through studying Aquinas, he became a convert. In other words, he kind of became a convert through philosophy. Now, I don't know if that's the kind of thing that can happen across the board, but I do think that the hopeful part of this is that there have been some really, really great Catholic thinkers in the last couple hundred years, and there have been some great Catholic thinkers who I think have something to say to us. Whether we believe we're philosophers, students of philosophy, they have something to say to us as human beings. Mm. And part of what they have to say is that the thing they have in common is they are all leading us back. And they're leading us back to Aquinas. They're leading us back to the Greeks, especially Aristotle, before Aquinas. And they're leading us back to what we were talking about just a little bit ago, this idea that there is an ultimate truth and that it is our job to pursue it as human beings. This is out there to find. The world is not a grab bag where everybody has their own truth or nobody has any truth. There is one. And that, I think, is, especially when you look at it in the context of someone who wasn't a Catholic, who wasn't a believer and became a convert in the process of studying this stuff, that's the kind of thing can give you some hope for the future.
There's a few people I think that are out there that are in that same category, and to know that, you know, these folks that genuinely sought the truth, and that seeking led them to the Catholic faith. I love hearing stories like that, because as a cradle Catholic, it confirms for me that I'm in the right spot. I often, you know, would watch The Journey Home on EWTN, and you know, all these Protestant ministers that would come over to the Catholic faith. And, you know, I thought how wonderful it was that I was born and raised Catholic, and these folks were confirming that I was in the right spot, because, you know, I don't know where I would be today with everything that's going on. The only thing that explains it is what Jesus taught us. And he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And, you know, based on what he's told us, whether it was why he was walking on the earth or through the saints over the last couple thousand years, it gives explanation to everything I've seen in life. There's not a whole lot that has gone on that I don't think is explained, can't be explained either through science or the faith, or especially the combination of the two. And so I take great relief in knowing that. And yet there's so many others that they just refuse to grab the theology side and believe that, you know, there are certain things that will never be explained through science and only through theology. And for me to have that, it is a gift, right? Faith is a gift, and you know, it's not anything we can beat people over the head with, but continue to pray for them to come to their own realization that there is a God out there, that he does love us, that he is all merciful, and that if we look hard enough and try hard enough, we will find him. And that's, of course, what we're going to celebrate in the next couple of days, is you know, that love, the joy, the mercy that he had for us, so much so that he was willing to come to earth and show us firsthand. So, Dan, it has been a couple of years. It's good to hear your voice. I wish you a lot of luck with the book. Like I said, we'll, for our listeners, it's not available yet, but when it does become available, we will be sure to let you know. And I'm sure that many folks will learn a lot about philosophy through it. So thanks for your time, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Ken, it's been a pleasure, and I wish you a very Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year as well, and to all your listeners. It's certainly a privilege to be back on the show, and I hope we'll get to do it again sometime.
Very good. Thanks, Dan. All the best to you and your family for a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Likewise, and God bless.
You too. Take care now.
Bye.
So, do have just a couple of minutes, and because we're not going to be on next week, if you tune in, you'll get a recording. But that's okay. Maureen does a great job of timing them up and getting some of the better shows. Yeah, it's interesting. Every once in a while, and I think even in the 4 o'clock hour on Fridays, we play some recordings, and I've run into people and say, you know, I heard this show last week, and it was like, scratching my head, and it's like, that show wasn't last week. And I was like, oh, Maureen must have put the recording on. But at this time of year, you know, reflecting on, you know, who we are and what we are as individuals, as a people, and especially as a church, that we need to be people of hope. We need to be people of faith. We need to be people of charity, people of love. And this time of year gives us that opportunity to do that, as we reflect on, you know, Jesus coming to us as a human being, remained divine, remained as God, but, you know, decided that he was going to come into our world in order to redeem us. And that through our relationship with him, hopefully, we get to experience some of that joy, especially at this time of the year, and that through our own enjoyment, our own I'm trying to think of the word, that it comes to us, that we're able to share it with others. I said that this morning you know, that each of us needs to have our own Magnificat. The beginning of it was in today's gospel. But, you know, as God comes into our lives and gives us all that we need, not necessarily all that we want, but hopefully get everything that we need, what is our response? What is our Magnificat? Do our lives proclaim the greatness of the Lord? And, you know, my wish today is for everyone to have a merry Christmas, a holy Christmas. Take advantage of whatever parishes are offering. I know my home parish of St. Luke's tonight's having a penance service. I'm sure other parishes are as well. I try to get to confession between now and Christmas. And then, of course, have a happy, healthy, and a holy 2024. You know, things are, you know, continue to get rocky day by day. But we know who our rock is. And now more than ever is time to cling to him and make him the center of our lives. Hopefully all the shows here on In His Sign Catholic Radio, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. here on 800 a.m. and over our website at inhissign.com, that we help you to draw closer to God and become more aware of his presence in your life, if not each and every day, each and every moment. And, you know, to give you something to cling to, especially when things are tough. To all those that have experienced loss this year and maybe celebrating their first holidays without a loved one, especially if it's a child, you know that you are in our prayers and that hopefully God will bring you some solace as we go through the holidays. So, again, I wish you all the best. I'll be back. We'll be back live on January the 3rd. Until then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Take care, and God bless.